In the quiet forest above Aspen, at a gathering of the distinguished and wealthy, I found myself caught in a moment that would later crystallize an entire cultural phenomenon. As I began describing my recent book on Edward Muybridge and the industrialization of everyday life, our imposing host interrupted to tell me about a very important Muybridge book that had just been published. My friend Sally had to repeat, "That's her book," 3 times before he went ashen with realization. This moment, a man confidently explaining to a woman her own work, became the seed for Rebecca Solnit's viral essay, "Men Explain Things to Me," which sparked a global conversation about gendered communication patterns and even inspired the term mansplaining. The book has become a cultural touchstone, referenced everywhere from academic discourse to social media, and translated into multiple languages. What began as one woman's anecdote revealed itself as a universal experience, resonating with millions who recognized this subtle but pervasive form of silencing. The confrontational confidence of the totally ignorant is, in my experience, gendered. Every woman knows what I'm talking about. That presumption that crushes young women into silence and trains us in self-doubt while exercising men's unsupported overconfidence. This syndrome is a war nearly every woman faces daily, including within herself. Whether in boardrooms, academic settings, or casual conversations, women frequently encounter this dynamic where their expertise is questioned or dismissed. Even with a successful writing career spanning decades and multiple acclaimed publications, I'm not entirely free from this persistent self-questioning. Self-doubt can be a useful tool for correcting and listening, serving as an internal compass that promotes growth and accuracy. However, too much paralyzes, just as total self-confidence produces arrogant idiots who barrel through conversations and decisions without consideration. We need a middle ground between these extremes, a balanced confidence that allows for both assertion and reflection. Credibility is a basic survival tool, especially for women facing violence or harassment. The statistics are stark. About 3 women daily are murdered by spouses or ex-partners in America, and countless more face domestic violence. Women's testimonies about abuse were routinely dismissed until they gained fuller human status when these crimes began to be taken seriously legally in the mid-1970s, marking a crucial shift in how society valued women's voices. Years after the Aspen incident in Berlin, another very important man sneered when I mentioned Women's Strike for Peace's role in bringing down HOAC. Despite my 9 published books, including extensive research on this specific topic and primary source documentation, his scorn was so withering I didn't argue, a common response many women have in the face of male authority, even when we know we're right. Later, I confirmed online that historian Eric Bentley indeed credited Women's Strike for Peace with striking the crucial blow in the fall of HOAC's Bastille in the early 1960s, demonstrating how women's political activism, though often dismissed, has shaped major historical events. Most women fight wars on 2 fronts, one for whatever the substantive topic is, be it science, literature, politics, or business, and one simply for the right to speak, to have ideas, to be acknowledged as possessing facts and truths. While things have improved since the days when women couldn't own property or vote, this war won't end soon. The battlefield has shifted from obvious discrimination to subtle dismissal and unconscious bias. I continue fighting for myself and for younger women who have something to say, hoping they'll get to say it without facing the same exhausting double burden of proving both their expertise and their right to have expertise at all. This struggle manifests in countless daily interactions, from academic conferences to workplace meetings, where women's contributions are frequently interrupted, appropriated, or ignored until repeated by male colleagues. In the United States, a rape occurs every 6.2 minutes, and 1 in 5 women will be raped in her lifetime. Yet when a brutal gang rape occurred on a deli bus in 2012, American media treated it as exceptional while overlooking similar crimes at home. Violence against women is broad, deep, and horrific, yet consistently treated as isolated incidents rather than a systemic crisis. The scope is staggering, from exceptional crimes to quotidian assaults. Though only one rape is reported every 6.2 minutes in America, the actual total may be 5 times higher, approaching nearly a rape per minute. We could discuss campus rapes, military sexual assaults, 19,000 in 2010 alone, or the 1,000-plus annual domestic violence homicides, exceeding 9/11's death toll every 3 years. Yet these crimes are rarely explained through the lens of gender. Violence is fundamentally authoritarian, beginning with the premise, "I have the right to control you." Murder represents the extreme version, where the murderer claims the right to decide whether someone lives or dies. This entitlement to inflict suffering breeds misery for both perpetrator and victim. In San Francisco alone, January 2013 saw multiple incidents where men assaulted women who rejected their advances. Domestic violence statistics are horrifying. A woman is beaten every 9 seconds in America, making it the number one cause of injury to American women. Spouses are the leading cause of death for pregnant women in the United States. This system of control explains why so many intimate partner murders occur when women attempt to leave relationships. Rape and violence constitute the barrage men use to control women, creating a climate of fear that limits women's lives in ways they've internalized so deeply they hardly notice. When college students were asked what they do to stay safe from rape, young women described elaborate precautions, while young men gaped in astonishment, revealing the chasm between their worlds. We rarely discuss the reality of gendered violence, instead placing the burden of prevention on potential victims rather than addressing perpetrators. This manifests in common advice given to women: don't walk alone at night, carry keys between fingers, watch your drink at parties. Online threats have become increasingly commonplace, with women who express opinions facing vicious harassment, including death threats, rape threats, and doxing. From gaming communities where female players face constant abuse, to political discourse where women politicians receive 27 times more abusive messages than male counterparts, attempts to silence women who claim voice and power differ only in degree from the Taliban's attempted murder of Malala Yousafzai for advocating girls' education. Our political and legal systems remain deeply embedded with misogyny. Before feminist activism of the 1970s, most forms of gendered violence weren't legally recognized. Marital rape wasn't criminalized in all U.S. states until 1993. Even now, rape victims are often put on trial rather than rapists, with their clothing choices, sexual history, and behavior scrutinized. The 2012 election cycle exposed numerous Republican politicians making outrageous pro-rape statements, like Todd Akin's claim about women's bodies preventing pregnancy during legitimate rape, or Richard Murdoch suggesting pregnancy from rape was God's will. Congressional Republicans repeatedly refused to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act because it protected particularly vulnerable groups: immigrants, transgender women, and Native American women. On tribal lands, the statistics are staggering. 84% of Native American women experience violence in their lifetime, with 88% of assaults committed by non-Native men deliberately exploiting tribal jurisdictional limitations. The ongoing assault on reproductive rights represents another front in this war of control over women's bodies, with states passing increasingly restrictive laws targeting abortion access, contraception, and women's health care. The so-called war of the sexes is extraordinarily lopsided when examining actual violence statistics. Women simply aren't committing the same scale or types of violence against men. Female IMF heads don't sexually assault employees, female military officers aren't accused of systematic sexual assaults, young female athletes don't violate unconscious boys and boast about it online. Only 6.5% of U.S. prisoners are women, and violent crimes committed by women are rare. Women commit only 14.7% of homicides and less than 1% of reported rapes. We need to address how masculinity is imagined and violence is normalized and passed to boys through media, sports culture, and social conditioning. Traditional masculine ideals of dominance, aggression, and emotional suppression contribute to violence. Encouragingly, many men are becoming good allies in this fight, working to redefine healthy masculinity and challenge misogynistic behavior. Women's liberation isn't about taking power from men in some zero-sum game. We're either free together or enslaved together. The mindset of domination that underlies gendered violence ultimately imprisons everyone, distorting human relationships and limiting the full expression of both masculine and feminine potential. When Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the powerful head of the International Monetary Fund, allegedly assaulted an African immigrant hotel maid in a New York luxury suite, worlds literally collided. This heavy-handed fable mirrored the IMF's own relationship with the Global South: colonization, exploitation, and silencing. The IMF was a predatory force that created devastating economic conditions across the Global South. Whatever you think of Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's oil-rich loans allowed Argentina to pay off IMF debt early and set saner economic policies. Since the 1999 Seattle protests sparked a global movement, there has been successful revolt against IMF policies, particularly in Latin America, changing economic debates and enriching our imaginations about economic possibilities. Strauss-Kahn's alleged predatory behavior toward women reveals how those who control the fate of the world can generate fear, misery, and injustice around them. Unlike consensual U.S. political sex scandals, this was about violence and denial of basic human rights. What's remarkable is that police believed this hotel maid, demonstrating democracy's promise that everyone has a voice regardless of wealth or power. The IMF sex scandal resonates because it mirrors larger global relationships, the IMF's assault on the poor as part of our era's class war. Bill Clinton made remarkable admissions about these failed policies, acknowledging in 2008 that for 30 years, we all blew it by treating food as just another trade product. He admitted his policies destroyed Haiti's capacity to feed itself. A hotel maid may end the career of one of the world's most powerful men, just as housekeeper Nikki Diaz helped derail billionaire Meg Whitman's California gubernatorial campaign by speaking out about being fired and denied wages after 9 years of service. These struggles are microcosms of our time's great world war. Sometimes we win skirmishes, but the war continues. Feminism fundamentally transformed marriage from a hierarchical relationship to an egalitarian one, paving the way for same-sex marriage. This shift challenged centuries of prescribed gender roles where husbands held authority over wives. Because marriages between two people of the same gender are inherently egalitarian, they naturally question traditional assumptions about who should fulfill specific roles in a partnership. Gay men and lesbians have expanded our understanding of what qualities are considered masculine or feminine, demonstrating that traits like nurturing, leadership, emotional expression, and financial management aren't tied to gender. These evolving perspectives benefit straight couples by offering new models for dividing household responsibilities, sharing emotional labor, and making decisions. Same-sex couples often approach tasks based on individual skills and preferences rather than gender expectations, creating more flexible and equitable partnerships. For example, in same-sex households, partners typically negotiate childcare, career priorities, and domestic duties without defaulting to gender-based assumptions. American conservatives consistently resist this egalitarian shift, though they rarely acknowledge their primary concern is preserving traditional gender hierarchies. Instead, they construct arguments claiming marriage exists primarily for procreation and child-rearing. This position ignores numerous realities. Many heterosexual marriages are childless by choice, others involve adoption or assisted reproduction, and countless children are successfully raised by grandparents, single parents, or other family configurations. Courts have repeatedly dismissed these procreation-based arguments as legally insufficient and logically inconsistent. Historical examples illuminate how deeply ingrained gender inequality was in marriage. Consider the case of the 91-year-old man who, in his younger years, simply informed his wife they were moving across the country for his new job, a unilateral decision that was socially acceptable at the time. Such authority was considered a husband's prerogative, regardless of its impact on his wife's career, social connections, or personal aspirations. Marriage equality threatens this long-standing inequality by demonstrating that successful partnerships can thrive without prescribed gender roles. This benefits everyone who values equal partnership, straight or gay, married or unmarried. The movement has accelerated conversations about consent, mutual respect, and shared decision-making in all relationships. It's time to fully embrace equality between genders, among partners, and across all relationship configurations, recognizing that when we liberate ourselves from rigid role expectations, we create space for more authentic and satisfying partnerships. In Ana Teresa Fernandez's striking painting, a woman hangs laundry wearing black high heels. Only her fingers and strong brown calves are visible, her body obscured by a white sheet that simultaneously reveals her contours in the wind. Her shadow stretches like a dark bird across a stark landscape. This ordinary act becomes extraordinary through painting, which invokes everything while saying nothing specific, presenting an open question rather than answers. The woman both exists and is obliterated. Women's obliteration extends to genealogy. My friend from India discovered her 1,000-year family tree includes no women, not herself, her mother, or any grandmothers. Only fathers and sons exist, creating a lineage that erases half of humanity. This pattern appears in Western tradition too, from biblical begats to the tree of Jesse, ancestor of the family tree concept. When we eliminate mothers, grandmothers, and great-grandmothers from our lineage, we narrow a forest to a tree, a web to a line. This same linear narrative appears in art history, where Picasso supposedly begat Pollock, who begat Warhol, ignoring diverse influences. Women disappear through naming conventions too. Until recently, English-speaking married women were addressed by their husbands' names, Mrs. Arthur Nichols instead of Charlotte Bronte. This practice reflected English law, which, as Blackstone wrote in 1765, suspended a woman's legal existence during marriage, incorporating her into her husband's identity. Under coverture, a woman had no separate existence. Her husband covered her like a sheet, like a shroud, like a screen. Female non-existence takes many forms. In Afghanistan, women disappeared behind veils so completely that in a New York Times photo, what appeared to be drapery was actually a fully veiled woman. Veils functioned as portable architecture of confinement, marking a woman as belonging to one man. During Argentina's Dirty War, 1976 to 1983, the military junta disappeared 15,000-30,000 dissidents. The first to resist were mothers, Las Madres de la Plaza de Mayo, who appeared before the presidential mansion wearing white kerchiefs embroidered with their children's names and disappearance dates. They refused to leave, walking when forbidden to sit, returning despite attacks and arrests. Their motherhood provided emotional and biological ties that generals couldn't dismiss as criminal, becoming armor for a new kind of politics. When campus rapes occurred at a university, authorities told women students to stay inside after dark. Pranksters responded with posters suggesting all men be excluded after dark, an equally logical solution that shocked men unaccustomed to having their movements restricted. While we easily recognize Argentina's disappearances as crimes, what do we call millennia of women's disappearance from public life, legal standing, and voice? About 66,000 women are killed annually by men worldwide in what's now called femicide, most by intimate partners. These deaths often follow years of being silenced and erased. Every woman who appears publicly wrestles with forces that would have her disappear or control her story. Telling your own story is already a victory, already a revolt. The white fabric in Fernandez's painting recalls Spanish artist Francisco de Zurbarán's 17th-century paintings of saints in white robes, where fabric both hides bodies and defines their space. While women spun and wove most fabric in Zurbarán's day, they couldn't paint. Few women could make images in public, define how we see the world, or create works we might view centuries later. Fernandez's 6-foot-tall oil painting transforms paint on canvas into the image of a woman hanging a sheet. The white fabric with expressive creases speaks of houses, beds, women's work, what happens in beds and gets washed out. The painting belongs to a series called Telorana, Spiderweb, connecting to ancient traditions where spinning and weaving linked women to spiders. In many Native American creation stories, Spider Grandmother is the principal creator of the universe. Virginia Woolf wrote in 1915, "The future is dark, which is the best thing the future can be, I think, an extraordinary declaration celebrating the unknown rather than false certainty." While most people fear darkness and the unseeable, Woolf embraced uncertainty as a creative force. Writers must engage with patches of darkness and resist the false comfort of pretending to know what cannot be known, allowing themselves to explore uncharted territories of thought and experience. Hope emerges from not knowing what will happen next, from the regular occurrence of the unlikely and unimaginable. While despair assumes the future resembles the present, hope embraces what romantic poet John Keats called negative capability, being comfortable with uncertainties and mysteries. This capacity to remain in doubt without irritably reaching for fact or reason became a cornerstone of Woolf's philosophical and artistic approach, informing both her fiction and essays. Woolf's genius partly lies in this embrace of uncertainty, celebrating the unpredictable meander in both mind and foot. In her essay, Street Haunting, a simple pencil-buying excursion becomes an exploration of darkness, wandering, and the liberation of identity. The seemingly mundane task transforms into a rich tapestry of observations, chance encounters, and philosophical musings. For Woolf, walking the streets offers both social engagement and reverie, a duet between outer world prompts and inner imagination, where each shop window and passing stranger becomes a portal to new possibilities. Woolf challenges the notion of a fixed identity, suggesting instead that the true self is varied and wandering, containing multitudes rather than the unity society demands. She views personality as fluid and multifaceted, shaped by circumstance and chance rather than predetermined characteristics. Her essays both exemplify and advocate for this unconfined consciousness and uncertainty principle, weaving between observation and speculation, fact and imagination. They model a counter-criticism that doesn't seek to nail things down, but rather to expand artworks by opening meanings and inviting possibilities, encouraging readers to embrace ambiguity as a source of insight. Woolf champions liberation beyond institutional and rational boundaries, demanding women's freedom to roam both geographically and imaginatively. In A Room of One's Own, she argues not just for rooms and incomes, but for access to taverns, midnight streets, and the freedom of the city, elements crucial for losing rather than defining identity. This physical freedom becomes metaphorical for intellectual and creative liberation, challenging the constraints placed on women's minds as well as their bodies. Her novel, Orlando, whose protagonist lives for centuries and shifts between genders, embodies this ideal of absolute freedom, demonstrating how identity can transcend not only social constraints, but also time, gender, and conventional narrative boundaries. Through this character, Woolf illustrates how embracing uncertainty can lead to a richer, more authentic existence unfettered by societal expectations and rigid categorizations. The history of women's rights isn't a linear path, but rather a complex journey with progress, regression, and contradiction. Feminism attempts to change something deeply rooted in most cultures worldwide, and the significant changes achieved in just 4 or 5 decades are remarkable. Ideas, once released, can't be contained again. Revolutions are fundamentally made of ideas. While reproductive rights may be diminished through legislation, the core concept that women should control their own bodies remains unshakable for most women. Social imagination wields tremendous power, as seen in the dramatic transformation of LGBTQ+ rights. In less than 50 years, what was once criminalized or pathologized has gained widespread acceptance, especially among younger generations. Despite progress, powerful forces still attempt to push women back into traditional roles. Susan Faludi's landmark backlash identified this double bind decades ago. Women simultaneously received congratulations for liberation while being told this liberation made them miserable. Contemporary media continues this pattern, with magazines and articles instructing women they're doomed to unhappiness if they don't follow traditional paths. Online, an anonymous volunteer police force threatens women who speak out with rape and death threats. Casual sexism persists in language like female careerism, while male careerism isn't even recognized by search engines, and tabloids patrol celebrities' bodies and lives, always assuming their ultimate ambition must be wifehood and motherhood rather than professional achievement. Feminism's future must include deeper inquiry into men, who commit most violent crimes and suicides and are falling behind in education and employment. How feminism benefits men and how the status quo damages them deserves more attention, as does understanding the men perpetrating violence and threats. Recent high-profile rape cases in New Delhi and Steubenville marked a turning point where sexual assault began to be treated as part of a cultural pattern rather than isolated incidents. The term rape culture entered mainstream discourse, partly through movements like slut walks that began in 2011. Young feminists are emerging as smart, bold, funny defenders of rights and claimers of space. Feminism, the radical notion that women are people, requires men's engagement too, as misogyny, like racism, cannot be addressed by victims alone. The future may involve broader movements that incorporate feminist perspectives alongside environmental, economic, and indigenous concerns, as seen in the Zapatista Revolution, where women gained rights within a larger social transformation. The ideas released from Pandora's box cannot be contained again. A woman walks down a 1,000-mile road, not alone and not going backward. The journey continues, with each step transforming not just individual lives, but our collective understanding of what it means to be human.